This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I should say right up front here that it's quite possible we could be getting breaking news from NPR about the state of the presidential race during the next hour of this show. As you know, the electoral count in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Arizona, that's been trending in Joe Biden's favor, and some kind of call or projection is possible, but I should also say it doesn't seem likely for hours. In any case, we will break for that and head to coverage from NPR if it does happen. In the meantime, we're going to be talking about what we do know about the results from this year's election here in Utah. The 4th congressional district race between the incumbent Democrat Ben McAdams and Republican Burgess Owens is still up in the air. Owens has taken the lead in that race. But aside from a few minor surprises in legislative races, Utah voters didn't really change much in the political makeup of this state. Republicans still won the statewide races. They held their supermajority in the legislature, took most of the congressional seats. Donald Trump got better numbers in Utah than he did in 2016. So we'll go through some of those numbers today, talk about what they mean. And we're going to begin with McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's been covering Donald Trump and the Republican Party. And we've turned to him a few times because he also writes about Trump's relationship with religious voters, Latter-day Saints in particular. We started this morning with his impressions of the moment.
For weeks leading up to this election, we heard a lot of commentators and polling analysts and forecasters warn everybody that on election night, there was going to be what they called a red mirage, where it would look like Trump did much better than he actually would end up doing once all the votes were counted. And it's funny, I think we all kind of heard that and agreed with it and nodded along thoughtfully. And then a lot of people kind of lost their minds on election night the results started to come in, and that happened, right? And I think that a lot of the kind of instant reactions on election night when Trump, for example, won Florida and Republicans were overperforming in Senate and House races led people to think that this was going to be kind of a catastrophe for Joe Biden. And, you know, where we're looking like we might end up is that Biden could end up with over 300 electoral votes. He is on track to win the popular vote by 7 million votes. And whatever you want to say about the broader kind of policy and ideological debates, this does actually look like a fairly strong repudiation of Trump's presidency, if not the entire Republican Party.
You've been writing about the president's strategy for dealing with the results. I think they're describing it as their election security operation. Are you seeing that play out now?
Yeah. I mean, you know, they've been telegraphing for months that if he lost the election or it looked like he was going to lose, they were going to claim that it had been rigged and that there was widespread voter fraud. And that is what they're doing. And they're filing lawsuits. And if you spend a lot of time in kind of the pro-Trump information universe, which I do, you see a lot of kind of out of context video clips circulating around that may or may not be what they're claiming to be. And so, yeah, basically the strategy is make a ton of noise, throw a bunch of stuff at the wall, see if anything sticks. But, you know, most of the smarter election law experts that I talk to, people smarter than me, say that it is very unlikely that these legal challenges will get the kind of traction that would actually overturn the results of the election. What it will do, though, is I think leave some significant segment of the country and the president's supporters convinced that Trump should have won this election and that it was stolen from him. And I think that that's a really, you know, dangerous, unfortunate thing for us to have to deal with in the years ahead if the president decides not to do what every president before him has and concede the election and kind of bow out graciously.
You wrote a piece for The Atlantic last week where you quoted one researcher who studies election disinformation, a woman named Laura Quinn, who she told you this, and you quoted her in the article, that the goal here, she said, is really not producing evidence that stands up for any length of time. They, and by that she means the Trump campaign, is interested in sowing just enough doubt to develop this narrative of fraud. That's what you think is what they're doing here.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the few kind of allegations of voter irregularities or voter fraud that have kind of gained traction have all been investigated and shown to be not credible. But that's not really the point, right? The point is just to create enough confusion and enough noise that they can get this narrative seeded. And it's not just so that Trump can retain power, right? I mean, it actually looks like, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic here, and maybe I'm misreading the room, but I have to say, like, I actually think our democratic institutions right now are holding up pretty well. The votes are being counted. The courts are doing what they're supposed to. And even, you know, a lot of elected Republicans, not all of them, but a lot of them, including supporters of the president, have come out and pushed back against the message that the president is trying to put out and said, well, of course, all the votes need to be counted. That's when the election is decided. Don't let him or his allies undermine the credibility of this election. And so I actually think things are holding up pretty well. But again, this isn't just about whether Trump gets four more years. It's also about Trump's post-presidency and, you know, what he decides to do from here on out, whether that's starting some kind of media organization or maybe even running again in 2024. He wants to create the narrative that he actually did win this election so that he can not look like a loser in his own kind of imagination.
Yeah. You've covered how religious Americans have been thinking about Donald Trump. Is it too early to draw any conclusions about how they voted this year? Doesn't seem they abandoned him.
You know, the best data is going to come out in a few months, yeah, which seems like an eternity. But the most kind of rigorous data on religious groups and how they broke down usually comes out the year following presidential election. But I think that we have seen enough to say that there wasn't some kind of, you know, wide scale exodus from the Republican Party or from Trump. Though I will say with the Latter-day Saint vote, there are some kind of interesting data points. You know, for example, Joe Biden has performed better in Utah than any Democrat since LBJ in 1964. Yeah. So Trump clearly very handily won Utah, but it seems that there was at least some amount of realignment there in the Utah vote. I personally found it very interesting that the voting precincts around Brigham Young University turned blue for the first time, I think, in decades. I think that's kind of an interesting signal. But it really is too early to say anything kind of definitive or conclusive.
Well, I'm thinking about Mormon women, not in Utah necessarily, but in Arizona and Nevada. Those were crucial swing states. Do you think that it might be said at some point in the final analysis that Mormon women played an important role in those two states?
I think that will almost certainly be said, not only for how they voted. You know, there was one poll from Quinn Monson out of BYU in Arizona, but right before the election, that he will admit has a big, you know, margin of error, and it was hard to pull, but found that Latter-day Saint support for Biden doubled over 2016 for Clinton. So it wasn't huge numbers. I think it's like from like 9% to 18%. But Arizona, the margin is razor thin. Yeah. And so really any amount of movement probably would have been pretty important. But I will also say even beyond that, Mormon women in kind of the suburbs of Phoenix, there was a group of them that were kind of radicalized against Trump and became really politically engaged. I actually had a colleague who spent election night out in those suburbs in Arizona with a group of Mormon women. And they had been, you know, canvassing for Joe Biden and talking to their neighbors and volunteering for the campaign. And you know, if you talk to Democrats in that state, they'll say that Mormon women actually did kind of provide an important backbone to the campaign there that I think in the final analysis will probably prove pretty important.
Utah Senator Mike Lee got a lot of attention over the last few weeks when he was campaigning for the president in Arizona. And we're laughing because he drew comparisons between Donald Trump and this character in the Book of Mormon, Captain Moroni. How do you think that landed with Latter-day Saints in Arizona? Or anywhere else.
Or anywhere. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think that if you were predisposed to be a really kind of hardcore Trump fan, you probably didn't mind. You might have even liked it. But my kind of anecdotal observation was that even among some Trump supporters and some conservative Mormons, there was a pretty visceral kind of backlash to that. And I think it says something kind of interesting about Mormon politics, which is that unlike, for example, evangelical politics and even, you know, Jewish politics in certain parts of the country, Mormonism is really not used to having its like scriptural characters or scriptural verses politicized quite so overtly, you know? And I think that to a lot of Latter-day Saints, it kind of rubbed them the wrong way. If you looked at Mike Lee's social media accounts after that, kind of just a day or two after he said that, there was just a flood of negative comments from Latter-day Saints who were saying that they were repulsed by this, that they thought it was completely inappropriate, even blasphemous. And wow. You know, to his credit, Senator Lee did kind of backpedal a little bit. He didn't fully take it back, but he acknowledged that maybe this wasn't the right phrasing or the right kind of place to make the point that he was trying to make. But I thought that was kind of interesting, that reaction.
Well, some negative reaction, but also some funny reaction. There was a meme that I saw going around. I'll quote a little bit of it because I thought it was kind of funny. And this is obviously in Book of Mormon language. Let's see. It goes like this. And Captain Moroni did boast of his strength and his wisdom and the length of his fingers. It was pretty long and it was pretty funny. And the fact that I think you have like young Latter-day Saints sending out these funny memes in response to it seemed to say something. I thought that was interesting.
It was really kind of a classic like Mormon moment on the internet. I saw a ton of funny tweets and funny posts circulating. And, you know, it does raise questions about kind of the broader Mormon conversation around politics and where it's headed. And, you know, if you talk to people who have studied Mormon politics for a long time, they will tell you that this rising, this young generation in the church now is unlike any other generation in the church in the past. They are not just more liberal, but also kind of more open-minded about an array of issues, more willing to kind of have open conversations about difficult things. And I think it'll be really fascinating to see how that plays out in the election cycles that are to come.
Let me ask you finally, and again, acknowledging there's no official call yet. This may drag on, of course, but the momentum clearly in the favor of Joe Biden. What kind of figure do you think can fill the void of Donald Trump, who had a very unique kind of appeal and style? Will Republicans and conservatives be looking for someone to replace him in the same way or move on and find some other kind of persona, do you think?
Yeah, this is something I think about a lot. You know, I obviously have covered the Republican Party and kind of the conservative movement for a long time now. Yeah. And one thing that I think Donald Trump has done, which is going to be hard to reverse, is that he's sort of conditioned an element of the Republican base to kind of crave red meat in a way that very few other Republican politicians are able to provide. Like when you go to a Trump rally, it's sensory overload. It's loud. It's brash. It's irreverent. It's unexpected. He says things that other politicians would never say. And I think that that could have a really corrosive effect on the party if you have an entire generation of candidates and politicians who are trying to mimic Trump. But I also think that if you look at the past several election cycles, generally the party changes their mood from cycle to cycle about what kind of candidates they want. And especially given the fact that Trump has lost, there will be some kind of MAGA diehards who stick with him. And let's not forget that Trump will still be around and he's not going to be quiet. So I'm sure that he'll still command some presence in the Republican Party. But I think that there's also a possibility that come 2024, Republican voters are craving somebody who's, you know, maybe just a little bit more normal, a little bit, you know, more likable, not quite as in your face. And that could open up possibilities for all kinds of different candidates.
It's McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
This is Rachel Martin with Morning Edition. If you're driving less these days and you've got a car you don't need anymore, consider donating it to support public radio. The donation could be worth hundreds of dollars in support for this station. Here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're breaking down the numbers in the election on Tuesday, explaining just what happened here in Utah, even though we don't know exactly what may happen in the country. Turns out not much in the way of actual change here in Utah. Voters mostly lived up to expectations, but we'll work through the results, talk about the trends and some of the motives here. We'll begin with Robert Gerke, a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, joining us again. Robert Gerke, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me, Doug.
Sonia Hudson is also back with us, a politics and government reporter here at KUER. Sonia, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And Emily Means with us, political reporter for KUER. Emily, welcome to you.
Hi, Doug.
So we're going to fold Quinn Monson, a professor of political science at Brigham Young University, into the conversation here in a moment. But I wanted to start with just your sense of those of you who are covering this election or have been this week, what it was like. Sonia, it's a pandemic. It's hard to go out and talk to people in the same kind of way. But give us a sense of what it was like to cover this election and some just sort of impressions of what happened this week.
Yeah, it definitely is a little different covering an election during a pandemic, no doubt about that. I was able to go out and talk to some people who were dropping off their ballots, voting in person early and on election day. And the big takeaway for me is that everyone felt like and agreed that this is a really, really important election. It's a very pivotal election, mostly with eyes, on the presidency. Mm. But there were definitely some impactful things here in Utah. I'm thinking a lot about Constitutional Amendment G, which shakes up education funding quite a bit. The jury's still out on that, but it's looking like that's going to pass. And things kind of went exactly how I thought they would go, at least at this point. Utah elections are very predictable in that way, right? It's a very Republican state. Obviously, we went for President Donald Trump in the presidential race. Congressional districts 1, 2, and 3 went Republican. The governor's office went Republican. And a few days out, we are one really competitive race, which is the 4th congressional district, is still undecided. It's still a pretty razor-thin margin. Pretty much going exactly how I expected it to.
Emily, did you get a sense that things were mostly driven by interest in the presidential race more than any local race in particular?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I actually did a story a couple weeks back, though I'm not actually clear on that timeline because what is time anymore?
Isn't it true?
But I did a story on get out the vote efforts for communities of color here in Utah. And I talked with some folks who were trying to get out the vote for Latino communities in Utah. Hmm. And the number one thing they heard for people who were registering for the first time was that they wanted to vote in this presidential election. So obviously, huge race, top of the ticket, and I think we're seeing has completely driven this record turnout during this election.
Robert Gerke, the turnout was massive, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to the Salt Lake County clerk, they're talking about numbers around 87%. It's similar in Utah County. I mean, statewide, all across the state, the turnout was just shattering records. More votes cast than ever before in an election in Utah. And it's intense interest, I think, echoing what Emily said, that in that presidential race, it seemed to be the one that sucked up most of the oxygen in the room.
What was your impression just generally, that's similar to Sonia, which is, and sort of what I mentioned earlier in the introduction, that not a whole lot did change, at least in the Utah political landscape?
Yeah, I mean, I think coming into this election, trying to campaign in the age of COVID was really difficult. We've talked about this during the primary as well. Yeah. I mean, it's hard for a challenger to make a dent in an incumbent. when you don't have nearly as much money and you can't go out and campaign face to face and do the fairs and the rallies and so forth. And so it was, I think you had a situation where the incumbents had a distinct advantage. And we are at the end of the day, a Republican state and a strong Republican state. And so that puts, again, the Democrats at a disadvantage.
Let's bring Quinn Monson into the conversation. He's an associate professor of political science at Brigham Young University. Quinn, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
So what are your broad impressions? I'm talking about the fact that not a whole lot changed. You're looking at the numbers. Did you see anything, and we can dig into this as we go, but anything that did maybe represent a kind of a trend or something that maybe did change or is headed toward change in Utah?
I think I agree with what's been said so far in that it hasn't changed dramatically. The one change in the Utah voting that I think is fairly obvious just from looking at the vote totals is that, as predicted ahead of time, Donald Trump didn't do as well in Utah as you might have expected a normal Republican to do. Of course, he did a lot better than he did in 2016. Yeah. And part of that is Evan McMullen's not on the ballot. There's just two candidates. Some of those McMullen voters, a lot of them went back to the Republican Party, but not all of them did. And I think that's maybe an important thing to remember.
So I want to hear from the rest of you on that subject. As far as you could tell, voters who Latter-day Saint voters in particular, let's talk a little bit about the Mormon vote as it relates to support for Donald Trump and how they were thinking about Donald Trump. Sonia or Emily, give me a sense of what you were hearing on that score, if you were hearing much in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously not having McMullen on the ballot had clearly a really big impact here in Utah. And, you know, something that I hear from a lot of people, particularly Mormon voters, is that, you know, even if they really have trouble stomaching President Trump's rhetoric, you know, they're focusing more on his policies. Something that is a really big driver for people is the issue of abortion. Like that just in and of itself will prevent them from ever voting Democrat. And you have a lot of people that really liked the tax cut reform that happened in 2017 under President Trump. And so kind of a typical line that you'll hear from Utah Republicans is that, yeah, you know, I don't love President Trump's rhetoric, but I really like his policies. And so that's why I'm supporting him.
Emily, what do you think?
Right. Well, Sonia did a great story on this regarding LDS voters and Evan McMullen. But I think to her point, you know, it's not just LDS voters who might make abortion their issue. It's really like any religious voter. I know I come from a Catholic upbringing, and that's a huge thing in my family. But we also saw, you know, really prominent LDS folk in the state, you know, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, or, you know, pick your favorite legislator here in Utah. Many of them did support the president. So, you know, we referred to a lot of Quinn Monson's polling on LDS voters and Trump. And I don't know if we were really surprised by the support that we saw here in the state.
Quinn, what did you see? I'm not sure if you've had time to sort of work through all of the results or the numbers, but can you say anything right now about the relationship between Mormon voters and Donald Trump?
Well, I think the story you brought up earlier about Mike Lee and his rally in Arizona raising Captain Moroni with McKay Coppins is an interesting one. And if you dig deeper into that, there's a couple important things to remember. If you want to categorize LDS voters with regard to Donald Trump, I would put them in three broad categories. There's the group that's been with Trump from the beginning, from back in 2016, and that group I don't think has grown dramatically even since then. And there's a group in the middle that has sort of been reluctantly with him and is the category that likes the policies but doesn't like the Twitter feed and right. Doesn't like the rhetoric but is okay with him. And they're not Democrats, and so they have reservations on abortion and other things. And so they would say they somewhat approve of him in a poll, but not strongly approve. Or they would agonize about whether to vote for him or not, but they don't want to vote for the Democrat. So a lot of them end up voting for him. And then there's another group of never Trumpers that defected to McMullen or crossed the aisle. And some of those went went to Joe Biden this time.
Yeah.
It's not a large group, or it didn't grow a lot from 2016, but it did grow some. I think McKay brought up the evidence we have in Arizona that the support for among Latter-day Saints in Arizona for Trump stayed about the same from 2016 to now. It didn't really shift, but the support for the Democratic candidate went up significantly, and that's important. The absence of other alternatives and the heightened importance of the election matters. And I think in Utah we see something similar in that without McMullen, a lot of those voters that are tepid about Trump that defected to McMullen went back to Trump somewhat reluctantly in some cases, and in some cases enthusiastically, and some of them went with Joe Biden. And in the end, you see a Republican president getting, you know, he'll end up with less than 60%. He's running right now 7 or so points behind Spencer Cox, which I think is indicative of the kind of defection that happened.
Robert Gerke, what have you found about the Mormon vote, I guess? And maybe, I don't know if you can speak to this, but I'm interested in young Latter-day Saint voters, how that may have compared to those of another generation.
Well, I mean, I thought it was interesting, and McKay noted this earlier, you have those precincts around Brigham Young University that went blue for the first time anybody can remember, which I think is a pretty telling statistic. I think it's significant, as Quinn mentioned, that President Trump was about 7 points behind Spencer Cox. I think that kind of tells you a little bit about the traditional Republican, maybe the independents, were not necessarily, you know, as enthusiastic about Trump as they were Spencer Cox. You can also look at history, I think. And if you take out the two elections, the Dole election and the Bush senior election, when you had a third party candidate, Ross Perot, in there, Trump's performance right now, if it stays right around where it is the worst since Nixon back at, you know, in the first time he ran. And Biden's is the best for a Democrat since LBJ won the state back in 64. So you know, it kind of shows you that there was a real tepid feeling, a sentiment toward President Trump in Utah. But again, you know, at the end of the day, he gets the electoral votes, but just maybe not by quite as much of a margin. I think it would probably be wrong to read too much into this. I don't think this signals a big shift in the direction Utah goes in 4 years from now. But, you know, I think it was a campaign largely about the president's persona.
I think people are going to be annoyed if we only talk about Mormon voters in Utah. So let's talk about just generally what we might be seeing in the way of, I don't know if any of you are identifying any sort of trend. Let's talk about young voters who are not of the LDS faith or others. There's a lot of talk. You're hearing a lot of talk like in Texas and Virginia and some places of, and we've talked about this on this show before, of states that are once solidly red, maybe trending a little bit more purple, even blue in some cases. Sonja Hudson, what are you seeing about that, if anything, that might give you some indication of where the state more broadly might be headed?
Yeah, I mean, so we talked about changes from 2016 to 2020 in terms of Mormon voters. But if you just look at Utah as a whole, Trump and Biden gained about the same, Trump a little bit more in support from 2016. Trump went up 13 points and Biden went up 10 from Clinton. And so to me, that's really interesting that they both, it says that that group in the middle kind of actually split, you know, not totally evenly, but not hugely in Trump's favor. And so, I mean, just in general, right, younger voters tend to lean more to the left. And I think that that could definitely have an impact, but not for quite a long time here in Utah. And Emily actually talked to some young voters about kind of what they're thinking about. I'm curious to hear from her what her overall impressions were.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think, and speaking as a young person, the young vote isn't monolithic, right? Yeah. Like, if we have young Republicans who are interested in issues that young Democrats might not be. But some things I heard from younger voters is they're worried about climate change, they're worried about the economy and the pandemic, and lots of things that older people are worried about too. But I think something that maybe mobilized people for this election were the movements that we saw throughout the spring and summer around police reform and police brutality and racial injustice, things like that. A lot of young people were leading those efforts. And, you know, groups like Voterize that we have here in Utah, which work to engage young people and make sure they register to vote, they were at those rallies. They were at those protests registering people. So, you know, this is an issue that young people in Utah seem to care about. We saw a lot of those protests over the summer. So you would guess that some people are passionate about those issues. But I think that, you know, these sorts of movements are what will drive younger voters across the country to be more engaged in electoral politics and just community organizing as a whole.
Yeah, I've just seen levels of enthusiasm and engagement from younger voters in ways that I have not seen before in the recent past. So that'll definitely have an impact.
Okay, let's talk about some of the races. Let's start with governor. And I don't think anyone was surprised that Utah Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox won handily over his Democratic challenger, Chris Peterson. That seems like the really crucial race was the primary. It's often that way in the Republican primary. So no surprises there. Robert Grigsby, and I want to hear the rest of you on this too, but what kind of a governor do you expect him to be? I mean, govern in the same kind of model that Governor Herbert has, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because outside of, you know, 9 months Spencer spent in the House of Representatives and his time as lieutenant governor, you know, we really don't have much to go by on his record. So we got a little bit of a flavor of it yesterday, I think, when he announced his transition team. He's got John Pierpont as his incoming chief of staff. I think you can probably get an indication of how confident he was going to run, that Mr. Pierpont's been serving as his chief of staff since July. So he had a pretty good idea that he was going to prevail in this. But he hired former Tribune editor Jennifer Napier Pierce as his communications director. He's got a transition team made up of, you know, prominent Republicans who are going to sort of do a top down review of state government. I think what I'm hearing from Spencer and everybody else can contribute, I guess, but what I'm hearing is that he wants to lead from the middle. He wants to be the governor of all Utahns, which is good, I think, but also sort of be a big idea guy, you know, and not necessarily. Gary Herbert, I think, is sort of known as an effective manager, but didn't really have, you know, big initiatives that he pushed during his time. And I think you're going to maybe see a little bit more of that from Governor Cox.
Sonia, you said that Spencer Cox's speech that he gave sounded more like a speech from a Democrat maybe than a Republican. You were struck by that.
Yeah, I was really struck by that. I was sitting in the exact same studio that I'm sitting in right now listening to it on election night. And I think what Spencer Cox is trying to do is really, you know, stay with these Republican economic principles. You know, he talked about, you know, being for lower taxes, also, you know, Republican social issues. He talked about being pro-life, but he said, you know, we have let other parties, read the Democratic Party, you know, lead on issues of equality and justice and equal treatment for people regardless of race, religion, you know, economic status. And he said, you know, as Republicans, we need to take that back. We need to be the party of selflessness, not selfishness. And so a lot of what he was talking about, you know, these issues of justice and social issues and taking care of everyone, that is a message you have heard more from Democrats. And I think that Cox really wants to take that back and, you know, lift all people up. And so leading from the middle is definitely a good way to phrase that.
Quinn Monsant, is leading from the middle align with the kind of disposition of Utah voters, most of them?
I don't know if I would call it leading from the middle as much as I would say that I think Spencer Cox is clearly a conservative, but he has a conciliatory tone. And so he's going to look to to listen and accommodate voices from the middle whenever he can. But he's still very pro-life. I think on guns and other things, he has a very conservative record.
But he's a reluctant
Trump supporter. He's the anti-Trump on Twitter. Right. He's a nice guy. And I think he's interested in listening and talking to people from the other side and genuinely doing so. I think he's very genuine in that. And I think listening matters because good ideas come from the other side, and he will listen and hear good ideas and incorporate them.
I wonder how much tolerance he'll have for message bills from really ultra-right legislators. That always comes up. What do you guys think? Is he going to indulge the really sort of right-wing behavior that you often see during the legislative session, for example?
I think it really depends on the topic, right? Like, for example, this legislative session, we saw a really kind of far-right message bill about abortion. That is something I think that if Cox had been in the governor's office, he would have supported, just like Governor Gary Herbert did. But also, you know, as Robert pointed out earlier, we really don't know. Like, we have, as the lieutenant governor, you kind of take a back seat and defer to the governor. We kind of have to wait and see how he fills that office.
Robert, what do you think?
I agree with what Sonia said. I also think that it's important to remember that Spencer Cox, and this is kind of noteworthy too, he's from rural Utah, and, you know, our governors for decades have been either from Salt Lake County or, in Gary Herbert's case, Utah County. Yeah. And so I think that kind of tells you a little bit about where his heart is. I think it means he's going to be very conservative on public lands. He's very focused on rural economic development. He's going to side a lot of times with the rural county commissioners. And as a legislator, at least, he voted for had a pro-gun voting record. So, you know, I think that tells you a little bit about his history, can tell you a little bit about where he's going to go as a governor.
It's Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. We have Sonia Hudson and Emily Means of KUER. Also with us, Quinn Monson's an associate professor of political science at Brigham Young University. We need to take a break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about the result of the election here in Utah today. The fourth congressional race, I should mention, between the incumbent Democrat Ben McAdams and Republican challenger Burgess Owens is extremely tight at the moment. Owens holds the lead. But there weren't really any other big surprises or changes in Utah politics. I should mention also, for those waiting for news about the state of the presidential election, we will go to NPR for live coverage if there are any calls or major projections to be made. Joining us on the program is Robert Gerke from the Salt Lake Tribune. We have Sonia Hudson and Emily Means from KUER with us, and Quinn Monson, associate professor of political science at Brigham Young University. Let's talk about that fourth congressional district. Robert Gerke, you said the thing that seems to characterize it is it was just downright nasty. Maybe as nasty as we've seen in the state in a while?
Yeah, I mean, I think the last two races have been characterized by their attack ads and the amount of money that's been spent on them. This obviously was no exception. I don't feel like this race was necessarily revolving around issues so much as it was, you know, negative personal attacks and the money spent from outside groups. It is a very, very close district, obviously, you know. McAdams won it by 694 votes. Mm-hmm. Everybody, all the national handicappers said this was going to be one of the top races in the country, if not the top race in the country. And it lived up to the billing, I guess, in that regard. Right now, you know, Burgess Owens has a lead of a little over 2,000 votes. But right now, the votes that are remaining to be counted favor McAdams pretty heavily. There's only about 3,000 votes left to be counted in Utah County. There's somewhere around 70 or 80,000 likely in Salt Lake County. And so once those Salt Lake County votes come in, it's likely in my estimation, I guess, that we'll see this race swing back to McAdams.
It's like breaking down Nevada for the presidential election.
It is. And there's nothing more dangerous than a journalist doing math.
Sonia, Emily, what are your impressions of that 4th congressional district race? Are you seeing anything there that stands out?
Yeah, nasty is definitely the word that comes to mind. Yeah. I mean, I don't think any of us could escape those ads either on social media or on TV. Robert's right. You know, Salt Lake County has a lot more ballots to count. Utah County was really just chugging through ballots yesterday. They actually did a second kind of surprise drop in the evening as well. So we'll get some more results late this afternoon. Salt Lake County said they're going to release results around 4 p.m. Right. And just tons of money being spent in this race. Another interesting impact of however this race ends up falling is, you know, we're redistricting next year based on the results of this year's census. And redistricting, although we do this year for the first time have an independent redistricting commission because of a proposition that was passed by voters in 2018. But they're an advisory commission. They don't have any real power. It's the legislature that draws these lines. And, you know, the 4th congressional district is only about 10 years old. And so it'll be interesting to see how much the Republicans try to or if they try to redraw these districts in a way that might favor Republicans, especially if we, you know, McAdams is reelected and now you have, a two-term Democrat in actually a pretty Republican district. We might see the impacts of this far beyond.
Well, they've got to redraw it, right? They're not going to stand for a 700 vote win from a Democrat.
Well, we'll see what the margin ends up being this time. That's what it was in 2018.
No.
Most political scientists will tell you they'll probably redraw it.
Hey, we have a political scientist. What do you think, Quinn Monson?
If I had to put money on it right now, I'd bet that they would mess with McAdams' district for sure. One of the things I noticed about that race that is a little unexpected in my view is that because I was involved heavily in the 2018 race with Mia Love consulting on her campaign, and I see Burgess Owens as significantly to the right of Mia Love.
Yeah.
And McAdams is the same McAdams. I mean, he's got a little more public of a record because he's been there for a couple of years and has some votes and things, but same guy, same record. Owens is further to the right, and yet we end up in basically the very same place. I mean, no matter who wins, we're basically in the same place as 2 years ago in terms of the proportions. So what's going on here? I don't know, except to say that I would have guessed that McAdams would have done just a little bit better and would have been able to paint McAdams a little more successfully as too extreme for the district. And the fact that that wasn't done or wasn't possible or didn't succeed is fascinating to me. The other thing that's interesting that I will look at some point is to compare the relative proportion of votes in the race that came from Utah County versus Salt Lake County. Utah County finally got around to going all vote by mail in 2018 for the first time, and now in 2020 it's a presidential election where the voters are used to it. And the state party seems to be a lot more engaged in turnout and GOTV in the 4th district this time around compared to last time. That could have mattered for Burgess Owens. And then the last observation I'd make about that race is that we have a nail biter of a race in Utah, and the contrasting reaction of the candidates with the presidential candidates, especially between Burgess Owens and Donald Trump, is quite striking, because it underscores for me the importance of norms and of good behavior, and of the fact that we have a Republican-controlled state, largely Republican-controlled election apparatus, and even a Democratic county clerk in Salt Lake County, and yet nobody's accusing anyone of fraud. The ballots are being counted still. We're all patiently waiting. And Utahns are going to be reasonably confident that the outcome is correct. And part of that is we've had relatively well-run elections, and we have a track record with vote by mail that's successful. So it's really striking to watch a really close election play out here.
Yeah.
And it's very, very much the same as 2018. And at the national level, we have a president that is steering away from normal democratic norms of behavior in ways that I agree with McKay Coppins is pretty dangerous. But we don't see that here, and I'm grateful for that. So that's an optimistic note.
Yeah. Hey, Sonia Hudson, we're model citizens. We
yeah.
did this right.
I wanted to go back and actually touch on quickly what Quinn's first observation was, is that, you know, you have Burgess Owens is much further to the right than Mia Love was, but we're in essence kind of getting the same dynamics, the same closeness of that race. And I think what that says is that in some ways we may have become even more polarized and more tribal politics have become even more of a thing since 2018. If, you know, the same number of people are willing to support someone who's much further right than Mia Love was, that R next to his name really, really means a lot.
We're running out of time. I want to get to a few more things. I don't know if there's anything to say about this, but this Amendment C result was such a puzzler that you had, 200,000 Utahns who wanted to keep slavery in the state constitution, 19%. Does anyone want to say anything about that? I don't know what you can say about it, but that was weird.
You know, Doug, if I could, I mean, I'll offer this up. This is anecdotal, but I talked to several friends who were asking me what this Amendment C actually did. And they voted against it because they felt like it didn't go far enough in trying to curb the abuse of prison labor. I tried to convince them that that's not really what this issue is, and that's a discussion worth having. But they felt like it enshrined prison labor into the Constitution, and they didn't like that. So maybe that's some of what's happening here, or maybe people just – the default in oftentimes – is to vote against the constitutional amendments if you don't understand what it's actually going to do.
Yeah. Emily, I haven't heard from you in a minute. What do you think?
Yeah, that's because I didn't cover any of the juicy races this election. But I have also heard the same as Gerke just mentioned, that, you know, either people always vote no on constitutional amendments. I've also heard that people didn't think it went far enough. But then I've also heard, and again, this is all anecdotal, I don't know if we'll really be able to like get into the meat of why people voted against this, that maybe some people just didn't understand it. And to us, it seems pretty clear cut. And I know the legislature kind of went out of their way to rework the language to make sure it was clear cut. But, you know, for some people, they might not be plugged into this issue, or they might just not know enough about it. And so they vote against it.
Well, it gets a good segue. And Sonia, quickly, because we're running out of time, did people understand Amendment G?
Oh, I think absolutely not. I mean, it was worded in such a way where it seems really clear cut when you read it on the ballot. It's like, oh, of course, you know, I want to, you know,
give money to education.
Of course, I want to give money to programs that benefit children and people with disabilities. Yeah. Like, why wouldn't you want that? And what's not clear from just looking at that is that, you know, those programs are being funded. They're just coming from a different pot of money. And so, you know, on the surface, it's like, oh, yes, of course I should support this. But when you get down to the really nuanced look at this, that's when you can start to really debate it in your mind. And, you know, there are people who understand the nuances of it and think it's a really great idea. There are other people that understand the nuances of it and are afraid that this is a really dangerous way to go. Yeah. And so but I think most people are not going to dig into like the last constitutional amendment on their ballot. And I talked to some voters who clearly did not read into it. So I'm not surprised by this outcome at all.
Quinn Monson, do you want to defend polling?
Sure.
It was I think a lot of us are just sick of polling. It seemed like a bad night for polls in many parts of the country. But do you want to say something else?
I'll say a couple of things. One, it's a little too early to pass judgment completely, although I have to admit, and I'll do so right here on the program, that we released a poll at Y2 Analytics that had a 7-point margin between Trump and Biden. Clearly, it's not going to be 7 points. So there's something wrong there in terms of our ability to get an accurate sample.
Well, it seems like there's something going on with polling that cannot, for some reason, measure the Donald Trump part of the electorate. Like,
yeah,
there's something
and I,
there.
I don't think it's the a measurement problem, and in other words, I don't think people are lying on the questions, or we'd see no error on the Senate races and other things, right? What I think, at least error that's related solely to Trump. What I think is likely the case is that there's some kind of differential non-response. In other words, we're having a hard time getting diehard Trump supporters to respond to the survey at the same rate as other people is what I suspect is going on. But I would also offer that that, you know, the same methodology that we used in Utah that had a 7-point margin that was off, we used in Arizona, and we had a slight edge for Joe Biden in our poll over Donald Trump. And that looks to be accurate, certainly within the margin of error of Arizona.
Yeah. Robert Gerke.
So, I don't, you know, it's hard to explain.
Yeah. Robert Gerke, you remember the good old days when you used to just wake up on election day and wonder what was actually going to happen without looking through the polls and, or, you know, or refreshing 538 every 35 seconds?
Yeah. But, you know, I really do like this mail vote by mail because, you know, we were talking about constitutional amendments and people not knowing what they mean. If you have to make up your mind on the spot, just reading the language of the amendment, it's really hard to do. You know, the mail-in voting gives you more time to do it. And if that means we have to wait a couple days on the back end, I mean, heaven forbid that we wait 3 days to get, you know, to have an informed, you know, on the back end, to have an informed electorate on the front end and make sure we get it right. So I think it's, I think vote by mail has been great, especially, you know, in this age of coronavirus, people were able to vote in record numbers and stay safe. So I think it's, I think that's a win.
A win. That's a good uplifting way to end the program. Robert Gerke, thanks for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a ray of sunshine.
Gerke always inspires me.
Always inspires. Sonia Hudson and Emily Means, thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
And Quinn Monson, Associate Professor of Political Science at Brigham Young University. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.